May your thoughts be with the living. May your hand and eye be swift. May your thanks be with the giving and never with the gift. May your kindness be unfailing. May your ship glide by each shoal. May the helmsman of each sailing be the captain of your soul. May you pass through all life's dangers. May your lovers all be true. May you learn that this world's strangers were friends you never knew. May your laughter ring like fountains. May your heart be wild and free. May you walk among the mountains, but live beside the sea. Welcome to this special edition of Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. That poem I just read, that beautiful poem I just read, was written by a gentleman who died yesterday. And he's a gentleman I want to spend an hour paying tribute to. He was, and I guess will always remain, what the British press are calling today a counter-cultural icon. But he was a very special, I don't know if he would call himself this, but I'm going to call him a very special kind of libertarian. He wasn't a political libertarian. He wasn't very politically active. But he was a true entrepreneur in the most radical sense. He was a real capitalist, and his whole life was a testament to the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press. His name is Felix Dennis, and the reason I want to have a show about him now, apart from the fact that he died yesterday, is that he is my uncle. And I am going to spend this hour with you talking a little bit about his incredible life, and I have my good friend, Zach, on the other end of Skype. Hi, Zach. How are you doing?
Life is good, Robin.
That's good, man. That's good. That's what he would want to hear, I know, on the day of his passing. And you're here. Zach is here to help me if I blub. If I get a bit tearful, I've told Zach he has to nudge me back, right? So I need a bit of ice in the blood for this show, I think. But I think it's appropriate to pay tribute to my dear, beloved Uncle Felix. He's not someone I can say I was very close to. He was close to his mother. He was close to his lover of most of his life. He never married, never had children, at least not that he admitted. But he had a big impact on me. And he had a big impact on me because this was a man who took life by the scruff of the neck, and for whom liberty and freedom weren't just words. He pushed them as far as they could possibly go. And I didn't know this uncle of mine existed until I was 18 years old. When I was visiting my great aunt, that's my father's mother's sister, who happens to be Felix's mother, and after spending a long weekend at the age of 18 with this great aunt, my father, who was going to drive the family back home, said, "Let's go and stop in on your Uncle Felix." To which I replied, "Well, I don't have an Uncle Felix, do I?" But sure enough, I did. And at 18 was the first time I met him. And living not far from his mother, we rolled up at this beautiful manor house. Beautiful old manor house, Tudor manor house. And with huge grounds, Rolls Royces in the driveway, and scantily clad women at various locations wandering here and there. And it was something the likes of which I've never seen. I come from a very modest background. On my father's side are refugees, and on my mother's side is lower class, rural, you know, privy up the garden kind of background. So here was this multi-millionaire who apparently at the age of 18 I discover I'm related to. Actually, most Britons already knew a lot about him. I didn't, but most Britons already did, because he was a defendant, one of three defendants in 1971. In a hugely celebrated civil rights trial in which the state prosecuted three young hippies, 1971, and they were prosecuting these three young hippies for publishing an underground magazine called Oz. Now, if you're sitting by a computer, you might want to just type into Google Oz magazine. Three hippies who I think were just making it all up as they went along, who would knock out of some basement or other, and each month the basement changed because the police would raid them. They would knock out a counterculture underground magazine. And on one week, it might be about UFOs. Another week, it would be about marijuana. Another week, it would be about masturbation, whatever it was. But kind of topics that weren't mainstream. And they gathered quite a subscription list to these underground hippies. And the way they did so was quite remarkable, and my Uncle Felix was responsible for it. My uncle had sent a tape, a review tape, into the offices, the basement, of Oz magazine. And the BBC approached Richard Neville, who was the guy who founded this magazine, and wanted for a documentary on the hippie movement and the hippie counterculture, wanted to talk to Richard Neville about his magazine. Neville didn't want to speak to the establishment BBC, so he handed the BBC this tape that he hadn't listened to, and it was an audio review of Oz magazine by my Uncle Felix. And Felix, the BBC promptly took this tape and played it. And my Uncle Felix, still a young man living with his mum, heard this tape play on the BBC and found Richard Neville some days or weeks afterwards and said, "I want my royalties." And Neville said, "What the hell are you talking about?" He said, "I'm the guy who sent you the tape that you played on the BBC." Neville said, "Well, we didn't play it. I never even listened to it. We just gave it to the BBC. And they played it. We ain't got anything to give you. We didn't have any money, but we've got stacks of these old magazines over here. If you can sell any, you're welcome to keep what you make." So Felix got his many girlfriends to stand at strategic points all over London with piles of Oz magazine in the shortest skirts they had, going up to all the middle-aged men who walked past them and saying, "Have you got your copy of Oz this month?" Well, it was the first time that Richard Neville and Jim Anderson, Neville's colleague on Oz, had sold so many magazines. So Felix went back to Neville and said, "Okay, I sold them." And Neville was very surprised. And Felix had just got himself the first publishing job of his career. Felix made his money, over $1 billion as it was, as a private publisher. And if you've read Maxim magazine, famous men's magazine, then you've read one of his magazines. If you've read Mac User, Computer Pro, Computer Shopper, dozens and dozens of magazines he put out in his career. But between his making his millions in magazines and that start he had as a hippie making up as he went along, he was one of these three defendants at what was, as I said, in 1971, the longest obscenity trial in British legal history. What caused the trial was a magazine, an edition of the magazine, edition 28, School Kids Issue. So called because these young hippies, not long out of school, invited some of the kids coming up behind them at school to, you know, create the content for this issue. Well, one of these young 15 or 16-year-olds created a cartoon of Rupert the Bear, Rupert the Bear being a well-known character, you know, kind of cuddly bear character of the time, an Enid Blyton character, I think, if that means anything to you here in the U.S. And he drew a cartoon of Rupert the Bear, this lovable children's character, with a large erection that was being pushed in a wheelbarrow. And this was enough for the state to prosecute these three men for corrupting public morals, and specifically the morals of minors, a charge that carried with it life sentences in jail. And the trial began. Well, as you can imagine, they had trouble getting a lawyer. But one man did step forward, the man who is even to this day the most famous barrister in England. His name is John Mortimer, and he was at the beginning of his career. And he realized what this was. He realized this was, in American, we would say, a huge First Amendment case. This was about civil rights versus state suppression. And he made it into a case for that principle of freedom of speech. And this was the beginning of what was to make my uncle both famous and rich. We're going into the break, and I will carry on from this history when we come back. Back to this tribute to Felix Dennis, born May 1947, died yesterday in his home in Warwickshire, England. And when we went to the break, I was telling the story of the trial, the Oz trial, longest obscenity trial in British legal history, the summer of 1971, when it really wasn't okay, despite what we now think about the free love and era, it wasn't okay to talk about homosexuality and masturbation and marijuana and be open about it. I guess everybody knew these things went on, but we didn't talk about them in polite society. And it, by the time it went to trial, these three young long-haired hippies had a secret subscription list that included some of the rich and famous and connected bishops, politicians, you name it. So it was deemed to be very subversive. And because they published issue 28, the school kids issue, the state was able to make the case that it was targeted at minors. And because there was a cartoon of a children's character that was sexualized, that this was, in some way corrupting. But of course, what the state didn't realize was it was called school kids issue because it was written by minors. Not because it was aimed at minors, it was written by minors. And these things that were being prosecuted were actually created by minors. So these three young men, Jim Anderson, Richard Neville, the founder, and Felix Dennis, my uncle, went to trial. John Mortimer, a famous, still probably the most famous lawyer in Britain. I'm not sure, I think he's still alive. Well, whether he's alive or dead, Mortimer, I think, is still the most famous name in law in Britain. Took this cause célèbre, and it was such a huge case, and it was such a crazy case that the witness list now reads very it's full of interesting kind of people, people from the pop scene, people like Edward de Bono, just people now names that you've heard of, and it dragged on and dragged on, and John Lennon actually wrote two songs to raise money for these boys. One was called Do the Oz, and the other was called God Save Oz. I was just listening to them on YouTube before the show started. Anyway, the judge was a bluff old reactionary social conservative who certainly wasn't having what these young hippies were peddling. And he more or less directed the jury to find them guilty. I think there was four counts. They were actually brought up on four counts. Nevertheless, the jury acquitted them on all but two counts, two minor counts they were found guilty on. And my uncle was given 9 months in jail. The other two were given 12 and 15. And Judge Argyle, that was his name, said to Uncle Felix in the dock, "I'm only giving you 9 months because you are the youngest and the most stupid of the three." Well, they went to jail, and they had their hair forcibly cut. Now, this is very interesting because the press in the United States and the United Kingdom, now bear in mind there were marches going on in London and New York, full of people like John Lennon heading them up. I'm sorry, my phone is going. these marches were going on, and so this was a cause célèbre, as I say, and so there was, it had a lot of press attention. It was front page news on both sides of the Atlantic for a while. But when they were convicted and the judge directed that their hair should be forcibly cut, there was a shift in sentiment. Some of the right-wing press that was all for putting away in jail these young hippie countercultural subversives, some of that press decided that the cutting of the hair, the forcible cutting of the hair, was vindictive and was an infringement of their individual liberty. Well, it went to appeal, and the convictions were quashed very quickly because the judge had misdirected the jury. Obviously, a judge cannot direct a jury to find defendants guilty. That's not a judge's job. So these three men were let off. Now, that was a huge win for civil rights. It was a huge win for John Mortimer. It was a huge win for the First Amendment. And I have to say, I had a wonderful experience. At the end of my second year at university, I was one of the first to finish my exams. I was doing physics at Cambridge, and so I took this extra time I had at the end of the term or semester, as you know, to use the American word. I took the time to go to the university library, which is a copyright library, which means every single thing ever produced in English with any under copyright is in that library, anything produced after a certain date. It's an amazing library. Well, that includes, of course, the Oz magazine. So I got to read this piece of kind of cultural history and family history when everybody else was frantically revising for their, you know, second year exams. And to read them now, they're completely innocent. I mean, you wouldn't even understand what the fuss was about. They're just kind of a bit of a psychedelic mess, with some articles and images more interesting than others. It's kind of an experimental, kind of colorful publication. But anyway, this was what caused all the trouble. But it was a watershed. It was a watershed in civil rights and the freedom of speech in England. And my uncle took that experience in publishing and turned it into something serious. And a lot of the newspapers have liked to say for a long time that one of the reasons he became so successful is to stick two fingers up to the judge who told him he was such an idiot. Well, he certainly wasn't. I think he topped out at about £750 million, £1.5 billion, and he did it all by publishing. By publishing and by setting up a computer parts company, a micro warehouse, which he took public, and that was responsible for a lot of his wealth. But why am I talking about him on the Libertarian show? Well, I hope that's obvious already. But this guy was a consummate capitalist and a consummate fighter for civil rights. He always has been. And a massive philanthropist. He didn't use the word libertarian to me in the conversations I had with him. But he was very irreverent. He was the guy who encouraged me, unknowingly probably, to be a nonconformist. I always saw the quiet heroism in living a life completely and utterly on your own terms. And he lived it in a very libertarian way. His philanthropy was the making of a better world, where the state failed to do so. And he always kind of smiled wryly at a state that wanted to put him in jail when he was a young man with long hair. But when he became a rich man, sending in huge tax checks to the Inland Revenue, he would get invited to Buckingham Palace to pick up publishing awards. And what I loved about him was he never took it seriously. He never changed. He never stopped being a hippie. He just became a rich one. And I should say, I'm actually, I'm honoring him because he was a smoker for all of his life. And indeed, it was throat cancer that killed him. But he also loved a nice drink. Now, I can't afford the drink that was his favorite, 1947 Petrus. I checked before the show. The last bottle of that at auction went for $12,500 in April. So I'm making do with a single malt that I hope he would approve of. Zach, what are you drinking there, my friend?
Well, I had been drinking beer before we started this, and I moved on to water so that
I
stay coherent while
we're
doing this.
I don't know if he would approve of water, Zach. You know, we're going to have to put that right when we meet and toast him.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, as long as I've, you know, known about your uncle Felix, He's somebody that I had really wanted to meet with you. Pretty bummed about this whole thing.
Yes.
I think us having a ridiculously overpriced bottle of wine, over his tree and maybe shouting some of his poetry, one of these days down the road would be pretty cool.
Yes. I think that's right. And when you say his tree, I should say that I'm just going to quote him. He said, "I'm a born-again atheist, so there isn't going to be a funeral. I will be buried in a linen wrap in a cardboard coffin in my forest with an oak tree planted on my head." I will tell you what he means by his forest when we come back after this break. "This modern mania for interfering in others' lives," said my Uncle Felix, "usually under the guise of health and safety concerns, is highly irritating and counterproductive. Down with the nanny state." He was clearly a libertarian in spirit, and I think turning up at his house as an 18-year-old impressionable teenager before going off to university and seeing how you could live if you were successful and completely unapologetic and living life on your own terms was what kept me out of the meat market of accounting, banking, and consulting, for which my over-education trained me. And I'm glad that it did. I never had a chance to discuss that with Felix, but he kind of was always a bit of a beacon for how to live your life completely as an individual, not just to, give lip service to liberty, but to just completely live life on your own terms. He also said America is an empire. Now, he spoke a lot of America, did my Uncle Felix, because though he was English, America made a lot more money for him than he ever did in England. Most of his business was done in the United States. "America is an empire," he said. "I hope you know that now. All empires, by definition, are bumbling, shambolic, bullying, bureaucratic affairs, as certain of the rightness of their cause in infancy as they are corrupted by power in their dotage." So you can see why Blue Republican Radio is a good place to be honoring Felix. But I was going to say, from the last segment, just mention that forest. He said he's going to have an oak tree planted on his head and he's going to be buried in his forest. So what's his legacy, this guy with however many quarters of billions that he has left? His legacy is going to be this. He's using it all to plant a forest, to plant the largest deciduous forest, continuous deciduous forest in Great Britain. He started a charity. To the best of my knowledge, he seeded it initially with £250 million and is attracting about another £500 million from other sources. And he has been surreptitiously, quietly, and sometimes under other names and through companies, different companies, buying up land in the heart of England to plant, and planting it to make what he says will be called, what he said would be called, the Heart of England Forest, just for the pleasure of the English people. England, of course, back in the day, was a very forested land. But now we have very little forest in England, unlike in Germany, where you had 20-30% forested. England's only, 4 or 5% forested. And Felix, a great lover of trees, decided to put all his money into doing something about that. So that was the forest reference. Quite an extraordinary guy, as you can see. Quite an extraordinary guy. How you doing, Zach? What do you make of this man?
Yeah, definitely an inspiration. And
he inspired many. It's really interesting to see. I got a message from my father early this morning that he'd passed, and I went online, and the comments that people have left in the obituaries and in social media say so much to the impact he had on their lives. He's had a huge impact on so many lives.
Yeah, and stuff that I was just talking about recently about, you know, because I'm still an environmentalist, even though I'm libertarian. I just think it should be something that's personal. And, you know, your uncle said, well, you know, he had his trees things, and, you know, talking about how, he often talked about how important they were to ecosystems and all that. But then he also said stuff like the planet doesn't require saving and actually hasn't asked Greenpeace to save it.
Yes.
Just fits in with you know, my thinking perfectly.
Right.
And yeah, his gravesite reminded me of my favorite poet's gravesite, Conrad Aiken. And so I guess, you know, I probably got to read more of your uncle's poetry. But Conrad Aiken was, when he lived like 1880s to early 1970s, and his gravesite is a bench, and it has inscribed on it, it's in Savannah, Georgia, Bonaventure Cemetery, just beautiful place, Spanish moss hanging from trees and all that. And so inscribed on his gravesite, on his bench, it says, Cosmos Mariner, Destination Unknown.
I love it.
His wish for people, Mr. Aiken's wish for people, was that they would go to his bench, hang out, make martinis, and read his poetry. And a lot of his poetry is kind of like shouting kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I did this, and they've got, it's an amazing cemetery, so amazing they have like tours. So here I am screaming Conrad Aiken poetry, and you know, the tour kind of stopped in front of us. But I can definitely see you and I doing something similar at your uncle's place in England at his tree.
Yes, he was a very generous man. He was very generous to me. I have to say, I wasn't close. He wasn't writing me checks, but he gave me an open, and he didn't believe in nepotism either. He's a ruthless meritocrat. But he gave me an open invitation. That first time I met him when I was 18, gave me an open invitation to one of his estates, the one where he died in Warwickshire, which is near Stratford-on-Avon, near Shakespeare's birthplace. And it's this beautiful, massive estate, thousands of acres, and it's where he started planting this Heart of England forest as well. It is, for me, one of the most beautiful, most peaceful places I've ever been to. And I've been to a lot of places. I've traveled a lot. And, I got a lot of nice memories there. By complete statistical coincidence, of course, I would usually go with a young lady. But, you know, the next time I go back, we'll feel quite different, I'm sure. But I don't know what he's done. But to walk around the grounds that he made so beautiful, he commissions art. He's commissioned a lot of bronze statues, life size. I think actually 1.5 times life size bronze statues of his heroes and villains, which is worth the trip just to go and see. So yes, I will. We should go back and toast him there. You know, some time ago in an interview, he said that the best epitaph somebody had come up with for him was simply this: Felix Dennis, everything, all the time. Which I kind of loved, because that is how he lived his life. I don't think he went with that in the end, but I don't think there could possibly be a better one. So I will toast everything all the time. Because why the hell not, right?
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Well, what more to say about this man? Yeah, the poetry. The poetry. Well, so a few years ago, this billionaire businessman, ruthless billionaire businessman, turned his hand to poetry. And in very short order became Britain's very best-selling poet. And he writes in traditional forms, you know, rhyming poetry, sonnets, those kind of things, iambic pentameter. And because of the amazing life he has had, the substance of his work is so rich. And he spent the last few years just writing this fantastic, it's very unpretentious. I mean, this is what's great about it. It's just kind of a wry look at life. It's the kind of poetry that will move you, but that you will identify with. It's like he's lived so many lives, and he's lived them with the volume turned up very high. And I recommend anyone to take a look at his poetry. So yes, quite an astonishing life. And as I said, also a philanthropist. He got wind one day. This was a few years ago, and it came out many years later in the press that a boy in a village in Kenya had gone to the in rural Kenya. We're talking like, you know, poor, you know, living off a dollar or two a day, had gone to buy a loaf of bread from the next village. And the bread was wrapped in a newspaper. And in the newspaper was an ad for a printer's job in English. And this boy was very, very young, and he had only learned very basic English at his little shack school in his village. But he nevertheless sent a letter to whatever company this was in England, this printing company. Obviously, this was a proper job that was probably taken months, if not years earlier, and this old scrap of paper had somehow got to Kenya. I mean, God knows how this happened, what the story was. Felix somehow heard that this printing company in London had received this strange pencil-written letter from apparently a child, based on the handwriting, they figured, who was interested in printing, in this printing job in London. So Felix got his team of lawyers and sent them to Kenya to find this boy. And I think he turned out to be like a teenager, you know, that kind of young adult, student kind of age. And Felix instructed his lawyers to offer to bring this boy to London for a proper printing course, and then to set him back up in Kenya with the equipment he would need to run a basic printing business in Kenya. And he would do things like that, and he wouldn't tell anyone. And every now and then, some media, someone would find out, the story would get out. And you'd think, my God, what a way to live. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are so many more things that Felix has done that I'll never know. But that's how you do liberty and make the world a better place. Two fingers up at the establishment from the get-go. Make shed loads of money. And then, as he said, the best thing about being rich is you can give what you want to anyone and you don't have to bloody worry about it. Love it. Just love it.
Yeah.
Talk to me, Zach. I need a breather.
How's it going, Robin?
I'm good. Well, you know, the other thing, no, that's the libertarian thing. You know, the libertarians often get, we're all in for drugs and sex and pornography and all that, apparently, right? Well, Felix is one of the things I liked about. Go ahead, man. What you gonna say?
I have heard somebody say libertine before libertarian.
Yeah, well, that's true. And you're referring to me, and I've always said that tongue in cheek. And when I say, oh, I was a libertine before I was a libertarian, and I always qualify that by saying I'm the cleanest libertine you've ever met, right? I am safe. I don't do drugs. I've never done drugs. I'm sure I will never do drugs. If I drink more than two beers, I generally fall over. I've never smoked anything in my life. So I'm a pretty pathetic libertine. But what I meant by that was, in a modern and very positive sense, in the best possible sense of the word, again, with tongue in cheek, when I met Felix, I saw a man living that life. And I think, I'm sure I've read in a couple of places, you know, in the press over the years, that he's England's Hugh Hefner. He is. He's kind of like that, but with more taste, you know.
Yeah, he's even got like a Hugh Hefner quote.
Oh, does he? I don't know that one. Are you looking at it? Can you give it to us?
It's not like, you know, strippers or anything, but here it is. For me, temptation is life, and I have a gargantuan appetite for everything.
Yeah. That's him. That's the everything all the time epitaph, right? That's what I'm talking about. And so he did that. He actually spent, I've read 50 million and I've read 100 million pounds on, as he says, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And he did a bunch of cocaine. He went cold turkey a few years ago. It was killing him. And I remember it was about 12 years ago I discovered, when it came out in the media, that he was at death's door because of the cocaine. And
wow.
And I met him. I was in my late 20s, I think, mid to late 20s, when this story had come out. And I took my girlfriend at the time to stay for a few days at his place. And he was there. And we had kind of after dinner hang out one evening. And I said, Felix, I got to ask you, smart guy, you know, one of the smartest men I'll ever meet. What the hell are you doing with the cocaine? What were you thinking? And he looked at me and he looked straight at my girlfriend. And I am not making this up. And he said to me, looking at my girlfriend, I bet sex with her is pretty damn good, isn't it? And I said, yes. He said, well, on cocaine, it's 100 times better. But then he said, after a small dramatic pause, but the problem is, Robin, it will kill you. So there he was, ruthlessly honest. He'd push everything as far as he could go. And he really did push things as far as he could, you know, he could go. You know, he was about to die, and he stopped. And then he became, if you like, very sober. And he went into the poetry. He actually had a bout of Legionnaire's disease, and it was in response to that, he says, that he started the poetry. He's indicated to me privately that that's really just a story, that he'd kind of been getting into the poetry before the Legionnaire's disease, but that it makes, again, for dramatic effect, and he was always one for dramatic effect. But then it was throat cancer. It was throat cancer that got him. As I say, he smoked all his whole life, and after they operated on it, and the last thing he said to me, the last time I met him, was that that they had got it, that he was convalescing, and I was under the impression that he wasn't going to be killed by it, but it is what got him in the end. So yes, so I'm very sorry to lose him, because he was that beacon of living your life as you damn well please. I have been salaried. I was salaried for 2 years. I was an employee for 2 years. I believe he has never been salaried for a day. And I love that. I mean, I love that. And I love what he kind of stood for and what he represented. And this fearlessness, this sheer fearlessness. You know, he wasn't doing somebody else's job. He was giving jobs to thousands of people. He's the very best of what capitalism is, making all this money, employing all these people, and then blowing it away, planting trees, helping young boys in Kenya and everything else. We're going into the break. Be back. Welcome back to the last segment of this tribute to Felix Dennis. When I would meet him occasionally, you know, when I would go and visit, you know, stay at his estate for a few days, sometimes he'd be there, he would often express this concern that I wasn't using all this education I had. He would say to me, look, you don't have to go and get rich, but, you know, do something, you know, make some kind of difference, be a philosopher or something. And I said to him for many years, I know, I feel it, I feel that I'm underselling myself, I feel that I'm underselling my abilities, I feel I should be doing something more, I don't know what it is. Well, now I'm doing it, and I'm making a difference. I have more meaning in my life than I have ever had. Being part of the American Liberty Movement, I kind of feel this is where I'm supposed to be. I work hard. I love what I'm doing. I'm making a difference, not just in my life, but I hope to the lives of other people, just as he did. And I don't feel that I'm wasting myself anymore. I was very lucky to have sent my uncle a long, long overdue letter. I haven't written to him for years. And I laid out everything that we were doing at Blue Republican and everything that I was doing with my life. And I hope and I pray that he read it before he passed, so that he wouldn't think that I was wasting it all. I'm going to close with this poem, also by him. You think it made a difference to try like Robert Frost, to take the road less traveled, to play at getting lost? Or was it more by accident? I know it was for me. The oxbow lakes of habit, meandering to the sea. You think they made a difference, these choices, by default? No matter to the ocean, it turns all water salt. If you like that poem, if you like the one I read out at the beginning of the show, go to his website. I think it's felixdennis.com or .co.uk. Google him. You'll find a very interesting story, very interesting biography of a true libertarian cultural icon, a great man, a man who I was lucky enough to be able to call Uncle. Uncle Felix, if you can hear me, I love you. Thank you for everything. You've made a huge mark on the world. Thanks for joining me. Join me again next week.